All right, welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today we're going to be diving into Puritanism in America. This mm-hmm. is going to be kind of the first session in a course on American Christianity.
Okay.
And we're looking at religion in a colonial context. Uh-huh. So we're going to be looking from 1492 to 1789.
Okay.
Yeah. So we're covering about 300 years.
Uh-huh.
And you're listening to this because you want to get smart on this quickly but thoroughly.
Exactly.
Yeah, and so our mission here is to really extract the essential insights into American Christianity through this fascinating story of the Puritans.
That's right. We want to give you the big picture.
Yeah.
We want to look at how these early settlements were established and why.
Yeah.
And we're going to look at some of the nuances within Puritanism itself, because it wasn't a monolithic thing.
Right, right.
And also some of the really interesting and powerful reactions that it provoked along the way.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to give you a really clear and insightful understanding of this foundational period.
Okay. So let's get started at the beginning, or at least the earliest permanent English settlement.
Okay.
Jamestown, Virginia, 1607.
Right.
Now, Jamestown was primarily set up as a trading post
yeah.
for the British Empire. And so while it has the title of first,
right.
its religious story is a bit hazy.
A little murky.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it won't be our main focus today. Really, the motives for Jamestown were largely economic.
Yeah. Jamestown was really about profit. And
right.
And the settlements that we're going to be looking at today were driven by something much more profound.
Yeah.
Religious conviction.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're going to move north. And we're going to look at the Pilgrims Landing at Plymouth. Have you ever been to Plymouth Colony and Plantations?
I have.
It's really remarkable. You can really get a sense of what 17th century life was like.
It really is like stepping back in time. And to understand the bigger picture, I think it's really important to clarify the difference between the Pilgrims and the Puritans.
Okay.
Okay. The Pilgrims who came to Plymouth, they were Senartists.
Okay.
Or Independents.
Okay.
They had already decided to leave the Anglican Church in England.
Right.
Their aim was to find a place where they could just practice their faith entirely on their own terms.
Right. Now, the Puritans, on the other hand, at least initially,
yes.
had a different goal.
Right.
They wanted to stay within the Anglican Church, but to purify it.
That's right. Reform it.
Yeah. Yeah. To reform it according to their own beliefs.
Right. Now, despite this difference in their initial approach to the Church of England, both the Pilgrims and these later Puritans shared a really crucial conviction.
Okay.
They believed that the local church should govern itself rather than being dictated to by some distant hierarchy.
Right, right.
So this idea of congregational governance is really key.
Yeah.
And it runs through this whole early period.
So now when we think about the Plymouth Colony,
yeah.
two leaders really stand out.
Okay.
First, William Brewster.
Hmm?
He lived from about 1567 to 1644.
Okay.
He was the elder, kind of the spiritual heart.
Yes, the spiritual leader.
Yeah, yeah, of the community.
And alongside him, kind of providing political leadership, was William Bradford.
Right.
Born in 1590, passed away in 1657.
Mm-hmm.
And he became their first governor.
Right.
He really laid the administrative and political foundations for this group.
And speaking of foundations.
Yes.
We can't talk about the Pilgrims without talking about the Mayflower Compact.
Of course, yes.
This was a document that they hammered out on board the Mayflower before they even set foot on land.
That's right. They needed some order
wow.
as they were going to face the realities of establishing a new community.
Yeah.
And on a slightly more whimsical note, you might have heard of Plymouth Rock.
Yeah.
Which is this very famous symbol, but the actual rock is surprisingly small.
Is it really?
Yeah, it's so small they have it fenced off now because people kept trying to take a chip of it home as a souvenir.
Hmm. That's funny.
Yeah.
Well, it goes to show you, reality often differs from the legend.
That's right.
But the Mayflower Compact itself holds real significance.
Yes, it does.
It's stated that their venture was for the glory of God and advancement of the Christian faith and the honor of our king and country.
Right.
So even as they sought religious freedom, they still identified as British subjects
yes.
under King James.
Precisely. I mean, for them, these religious and civic aims were deeply intertwined.
Right.
Two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
And the compact also declared their commitment to combine ourselves together into a civil body politic for our better ordering and preservation and furtherance of the ends aforesaid, and by virtue hereof to enact, constitute, and frame such just and equal laws for the general good of the colony.
The general good of the colony. That phrase, I mean, it still resonates today, doesn't it? It speaks to their...
It does, yeah.
Their intention to create a self-governing society.
Yes.
That would operate for the benefit of all.
And it really underscores that point about their intertwined religious and civil purposes. I mean, for the Plymouth settlers, their faith wasn't just some private matter.
Right.
It was the foundation upon which they intended to build their community
and
even their laws.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So that gives us a good understanding of the pilgrims at Plymouth.
Yes.
This small group of separatists.
Right.
Who are seeking to live out their faith independently.
Right.
But the story of Puritanism in America truly takes off with this much larger wave of Puritan immigration that began around 1628.
Absolutely.
And this movement had a much more profound and lasting impact on the religious and social development of the colonies.
Absolutely. And this is where we see the arrival of some really pivotal figures who are going to shape the course of early American history.
Right.
I mean, we can think about four key leaders who spearheaded this larger migration.
Okay, so who do we have?
First, you have John Cotton. He lived from 1584 to 1652.
Okay.
He became an incredibly influential figure in early Boston.
Okay.
And not just in religious matters, but in the political and civic life of this burgeoning colony. Okay. He was a central pillar of that early society.
Okay.
Next, we have Richard Mather.
Okay.
Richard Mather was instrumental in establishing a Puritan settlement in Dorchester, which is now part of Boston, but at the time was a separate community.
Right.
And he was instrumental in setting up the religious and social structures there.
Okay.
Then you have Thomas Hooker.
Okay.
Now, Thomas Hooker is interesting. He actually led a group westward and founded Hartford, Connecticut.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And if you think about it, to make that journey from the Boston area to Hartford in the 17th century, that was a significant undertaking.
Right. Yeah, that was a real expedition.
It was an expedition into the wilderness.
Yeah.
There's still a very prominent Thomas Hooker Church in Hartford today. It's the fourth one on that very spot. And the Hooker family is buried there.
That's amazing.
It gives you a real sense of the challenges of travel and settlement in that era.
Yeah.
And finally, we have John Winthrop, who is arguably one of the most significant of these early leaders.
Okay.
He served as governor of the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston no less than 12 times.
Wow.
And he's the one who famously spoke of their new settlement as a city upon a hill.
A city upon a hill.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a phrase that still echoes in American political and cultural discourse, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Winthrop's vision was of Boston as kind of an exemplary community.
Right.
A place where they would glorify God, not just in the religious practices, but in their entire way of life.
Absolutely.
In how they governed themselves, interacted with one another.
Right.
For the common good.
Yes. I mean, it really encapsulated their aspirations for this new society.
Yeah. Now, it's also really important to understand about these Puritan immigrants is where they came from within the religious landscape of England.
Right.
So many of them were actually ordained Anglican priests within the established Church of England.
Yeah.
So these were...
They were deeply committed Puritans
who
initially hoped to reform the Anglican Church from within.
So their initial aim wasn't to break away entirely like the Pilgrims.
Correct.
But to purify the existing Church of England.
That's right.
According to their Puritan ideals.
That's right.
But they brought their Anglican background with them. But they wanted to reshape it.
Yes. And the theological framework that underpinned their desire for reform was Calvinism.
Okay.
So while they were Anglicans, their core theological beliefs were very much rooted in the teachings of John Calvin.
Okay.
A central tenet for them was the absolute authority of the Bible.
Okay.
Not just for personal faith, but for how the church itself should be organized and run.
Right. And this is where their major point of contention with the Anglican Church hierarchy arose.
Absolutely.
They weren't comfortable with the system of archbishops and bishops wielding significant authority.
That's right. They weren't comfortable with that top-down structure.
Yeah.
They favored a model of congregational governance where each local church had greater autonomy and decision-making power.
Right.
And this brings us back to the Pilgrims in Plymouth.
Right.
Even though they had already separated from the Anglican Church, their belief in this congregational model was a key point of agreement and connection with the Puritans who settled in the Massachusetts Bay Area.
It's also worth noting the sheer scale of this Puritan migration.
Yeah.
By 1640, just a little over a decade after it really gained momentum, it's estimated that around 20,000 Puritans had made the journey to America.
That's a huge number.
Yeah.
Especially for that time period.
So if you're in the Boston area today, you're really walking through the heartland.
You are, yeah.
Of what was once this thriving Puritan territory.
That's right. They established numerous settlements, including Ipswich, Salem, Danvers, and of course Boston.
Right.
Their presence profoundly shaped the religious, political, and social fabric of the whole region.
So what was driving this exodus?
Well, the Puritans faced increasing pressure and harassment in England under King James I.
Okay.
And various leaders within the Church of England.
Okay.
They desired what they considered a simpler form of worship.
Okay.
They felt the Anglican Church retained too many elements of Roman Catholicism.
Okay.
And they strongly advocated for congregational church leadership.
Right.
So all of these things put them increasingly at odds with the established authority.
So they were really seeking the freedom to practice their faith.
Absolutely.
And structure their churches.
Yes.
According to their deeply held convictions.
Precisely.
A freedom they felt they were being denied.
That's right.
In their homeland.
Yeah.
So let's fast forward a couple of decades. Yeah. In 1648, there's a really significant development.
Okay.
The Pilgrims of Plymouth and the Puritans of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, despite their earlier differences, managed to bridge their theological nuances and formally united.
Oh, wow.
In what became known as the Cambridge Platform.
Okay.
This is often considered the foundational document of American Congregationalism.
So this is where we really see the emergence of a distinctively American religious tradition.
Yeah.
The Cambridge Platform essentially codified Congregationalism.
Right.
As a new denomination in America.
Right.
It drew together these groups who initially held slightly different positions regarding the Church of England.
So the Pilgrims had already made the definitive step of separation.
Yes.
But their actual practices and beliefs regarding church governance, they aligned closely enough.
They did.
With
yes.
the Puritans' evolving views that this unification became possible.
That's right.
Solidifying this new branch of Christianity in America.
It's a good reminder that even within what seemed like this unified movement, like Puritanism, there were internal variations.
Yeah.
And that these groups could evolve and find common ground over time.
Right, right. Leading to new expressions of faith.
Exactly. Now, it's important to remember that not everyone was happy with the Puritans and their way of life.
Of course, yeah.
There were definitely some significant reactions and challenges to their authority.
Right. So they had this vision of creating a godly society based on their interpretations of scripture.
Yes.
But
their particular approach and their sometimes rigid beliefs weren't universally accepted.
Right, right. So we see several important figures and movements emerge.
Yes.
That really push back against the Puritan establishment.
Right. So let's start with Roger Williams.
Okay.
He lived from 1604 to 1683.
Okay.
And he was actually a Puritan himself. So he had experienced their beliefs and practices firsthand.
Right.
However, he became a very powerful critic, especially concerning their lack of religious freedom for those who didn't adhere to their specific doctrines.
Right.
What really distinguished Williams was his advocacy for a concept of religious freedom that went far beyond mere tolerance.
Okay.
He didn't just believe that different religious views should be grudgingly permitted.
Right.
He argued for the positive right of individuals to follow their own conscience without interference from the state.
Yeah.
A prime example of the Puritan practice that he opposed was the direct link between church membership in the Congregationalist churches and the right to vote in the Massachusetts Bay Colony.
Right.
Williams saw this as a fundamental violation of religious liberty.
Yeah.
So he eventually left Massachusetts and he journeyed south.
Okay.
Where he founded the colony of Rhode Island.
Right.
Naming its main settlement Providence.
Okay.
Which really reflected his core belief in divine guidance and individual conscience.
Right. We'll definitely have to do a whole other deep dive.
We should, yeah.
On his story.
Absolutely.
Another significant challenge came from George Fox.
Okay.
The founder of the Religious Society of Friends, or Quakers.
Okay, yes.
He lived from 1624 to 1691.
Okay.
Now, the Quakers were already a distinct religious group in England, having separated from the Anglican Church.
Right.
When they began to arrive in Boston.
Yes.
And the Puritans...
They did not extend a welcoming hand.
Yeah, they did not.
Yeah.
And their disagreements weren't simply about
right.
church structure or governance.
Mm-hmm, right.
There were profound theological differences as well.
That's right. Which we'll delve into more deeply when we focus specifically on the Quakers in a future episode.
Okay.
The Puritan reaction was quite brutal.
Really?
Yeah. Four early Quakers, including the well-known Mary Dyer...
Oh, wow.
...were actually executed by hanging on Boston Common for their persistent refusal to conform to Puritan religious laws.
Wow.
It's a stark reminder of the religious intolerance of the era.
Yeah.
Especially considering the Quakers were fundamentally committed
right.
to principles of peace.
Yeah.
Today, there's a statue of Mary Dyer near the Massachusetts State House.
Oh, wow.
Which is a poignant juxtaposition given that Boston Common was a site of
right.
public execution
yeah.
well into the 19th century.
Wow. So it really highlights that intense conflict
yes.
between this Puritan vision
yes.
of a unified, religiously homogenous society
yes.
and the reality of differing beliefs.
That's right.
And the desire for religious freedom.
Absolutely.
So many Quakers facing this severe persecution
yeah.
sought refuge in Rhode Island with Roger Williams.
Right.
Further solidifying its reputation
yeah.
as a colony that offered greater religious liberty.
That's right.
Now, we also have Anne Hutchinson.
Yes.
A really central figure.
Yes, absolutely.
In this narrative of early American religious history.
Yeah.
Her challenge to Puritan authority was really significant on multiple fronts.
She was a very important figure.
Yeah. So there were two primary aspects
yes.
of her actions
right.
that caused considerable upheaval.
Okay.
First, she began hosting theological discussions and Bible studies in her home.
Okay.
Now, these gatherings weren't limited to women.
Right.
Men attended as well.
Right.
This directly challenged.
It did, yeah.
The very strict social norms.
Absolutely.
Of Puritan society.
Yeah.
Which largely confined women's roles to the domestic sphere.
Yeah. It definitely challenged those traditional ideas about women's roles.
Right.
And secondly, Hutchinson's theological emphasis began to shift
okay.
away from the dominant Puritan focus on predestination
right.
toward a greater emphasis on the direct experience of God's grace.
Okay.
Her teachings were sometimes labeled antinomian.
Right.
Suggesting that this belief in God's grace freed individuals from the need to adhere strictly to uh-huh. religious laws
okay.
and moral codes,
right.
which was perceived as undermining the very foundations of Puritan theology and social order.
Right. So this led to her being brought before the authorities for trial.
Yes.
And ultimately, she was excommunicated from Boston.
She was.
And like others who clashed with the Puritan establishment, she sought refuge in Rhode Island.
Right.
Further cementing Rhode Island's image as a colony that offered a greater degree of religious liberty.
That's right. And Anne Hutchinson really stands as this powerful example of
yeah.
an individual who dared to question
yeah.
and push back against the prevailing Puritan practices and theological interpretations.
So that brings up a really important point that our listener yes. might be considering.
Right.
What was the difference in how Mary Dyer and Anne Hutchinson were treated?
Yeah.
Dyer was executed
right.
while Hutchinson was banished. Yeah. What accounts for that difference?
Well, Mary Dyer, as a Quaker, who repeatedly defied banishment orders
right.
and actively challenged the very basis of Puritan religious authority,
right.
was viewed by the Puritan leadership as a persistent and direct threat
okay.
to the stability of their entire social and religious order.
Yeah.
Her Quaker beliefs were seen as fundamentally heretical and dangerous to the community.
Okay.
And Hutchinson, while certainly holding differing theological views and challenging established social norms
right.
wasn't necessarily perceived as an outright heretic in the same way that the Quakers were.
Okay.
Her challenge was more focused on the interpretation and application of Puritan theology and the accepted roles within their society. So while her views were considered highly problematic and disruptive,
yes.
the authorities ultimately chose banishment as a way to maintain order without resorting to execution.
That's right, yeah.
So it really speaks to the nuances within their responses to dissent.
Yeah. Even though both were ultimately deemed unacceptable
right.
within their community.
Yeah, exactly.
So now let's shift our focus to the eventual decline right. of this powerful Puritan influence.
Okay.
A key indicator of this shift
right.
is the development and adoption of what's known as the Halfway Covenant.
A Halfway Covenant.
So tell me about this.
Okay. Well, the Halfway Covenant emerged within the Congregationalist churches.
Right.
Which, as we discussed, were the successors
right.
to the original Puritan congregations mm-hmm. between 1657 and 1662.
Okay.
And it represented a really significant evolution
right.
in how church membership was understood mm-hmm. and granted.
Okay.
So instead of requiring a full demonstrated personal conversion experience
okay.
and a public profession of faith in Christ
right.
to become a full member of the church,
right.
the Halfway Covenant allowed individuals who were considered to be living morally upright lives
oh.
within the community to become partial members.
Okay. So it kind of loosened.
It loosened, yeah.
It loosened the requirements.
It loosened the requirements. Yeah.
For membership.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this partial membership also extended to the baptism of their children.
Oh, wow.
Even if the parents themselves hadn't undergone that traditional conversion
right, right.
and full church membership.
Okay.
What's really striking about the Halfway Covenant is how it moves away from that earlier, very strict Puritan emphasis
right.
on a personal transformative religious experience
right.
as the prerequisite for church membership and participation
right.
in key sacraments like communion.
Okay.
The Halfway Covenant essentially broadened the criteria for belonging.
Right.
Making it easier for people who hadn't had that dramatic conversion experience
right.
to be connected to the church
okay.
and have their children baptized.
Okay, so for many within the Puritan tradition, this shift was seen as a dilution.
It was, yes.
Of the church's core spiritual principles.
Yeah.
A move away from the rigorous biblical standards that the early generations had so strongly emphasized.
That's right.
And so it's often interpreted as a significant step.
It is, yeah.
In the gradual decline mm-hmm. of that initial intense Puritan commitment.
Absolutely.
That vision.
Yeah. And this naturally leads us to a really interesting question.
Yeah.
What were the underlying factors that led to this shift?
Right, right.
Was it primarily a decline in the intense religious fervor
okay.
of the later generations
right.
that prompted these changes?
Okay.
Or did the increasing material prosperity and
yeah.
wealth
yeah.
of the second, third, and fourth generations of Puritans play a more significant role?
It's a bit of a chicken or the egg.
It is, yeah.
scenario, isn't it?
It really is.
I mean, the early Puritan work ethic was deeply intertwined with their religious beliefs.
Absolutely.
They believed in serving God through their daily work.
Right.
Practicing frugality.
Right.
Reinvesting their wealth into right. their businesses, their yeah. communities, including the church.
That's right.
But as subsequent generations grew up in a more established and prosperous society.
Yes.
We begin to see evidence of a gradual shift.
We do,
and
yeah.
priorities.
Yeah.
There's documentation of increasing personal wealth.
Right.
A greater tendency to spend on personal comforts.
Yeah.
Material goods.
Yeah. I mean, if you visit historic towns like Salem today, you can see some of the grander homes that
yeah.
were built by later generations of Puritan families.
Right.
A noticeable contrast to the much simpler dwellings of
yeah.
the original settlers.
And alongside this increasing material comfort,
yes.
there does seem to have been a corresponding decline.
There does, yeah.
In that initial fervent
yes.
religious zeal and focus.
Yeah, the later generation seemed to have been less intensely focused on evangelism,
right.
on sharing their faith with others,
uh-huh.
and on maintaining the very strict levels of church discipline
right.
that had characterized the early Puritan communities.
So the precise causal relationship
right.
between these two trends, the rise in wealth and this apparent decline
yes.
in religious fervor, it remains a subject of historical debate.
It does, yeah.
It's challenging to definitively say
yeah.
which was the primary driver.
It's hard to say what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Right.
But what is clear is that within a relatively short time frame,
okay,
maybe 50 to 100 years of their initial establishment,
right,
the intense religious focus of early Puritanism
yeah.
began to wane.
So that brings us to another question to ponder.
Yes.
If this initial very powerful religious force began to diminish,
yes.
what eventually filled that void
right.
in the religious and social landscape
yeah.
of the colonies
right.
What replaced this declining intensity of Puritan religious life?
That's a great question.
We'll need to explore that in future deep dives.
Absolutely. Understanding this decline really sets the stage for comprehending the subsequent transformations in American religious life.
Right.
The emergence of new religious movements and denominations.
Okay, so just to quickly summarize our deep dive into Puritanism today.
Right.
We've explored the initial English settlements,
right,
highlighting why the pilgrims at Plymouth and the subsequent larger Puritan migration to Massachusetts Bay were so foundational for American religious history.
Right.
We've examined their core beliefs,
yeah,
and some of the significant internal variations,
yes,
within early Puritanism, introduced key figures who shaped the movement.
That's right.
Discussed the challenges and reactions they faced from dissenting individuals and groups.
Right.
And finally, we touched upon the beginnings of Puritanism's decline, using the Halfway Covenant as a key example,
yeah,
and considered this complex interplay between religious zeal